The Commerce Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, March 1st, 2007. For the record, March comes in like a lion. So that's something to look forward to. And we have a guest, Senator Limmer. My favorite senator from representing Maple Grove. Yeah, that's about it.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm the only senator representing Maple Grove, so I guess I'm the most favorite one, aren't I? Madam Chair, the bill that I have before you, Senate File 241.
Yes.
I have a delete everything amendment that I'd like you to consider.
Okay. Well, we'll put the bill.
Should I start on that first?
Yes, mention? Let's do that. And I think do members have that? It will be the A2.
241A2
amendment. Senator Metzen will move adoption of author's amendment 241A2. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And the amendment, the bill is in the shape you'd like to discuss it.
Madam Chair, bill or Senate file number 241 as amended. Is a means to protect consumers from uninvited sales pitches, whether they're on phone call or mailings, after a consumer has already begun a contractual agreement with a mortgage loan provider. What we're beginning to observe in the marketplace is once a consumer begins the formal process of applying for a home mortgage, The key item that every mortgage company will find is a credit report. But just the mere action of triggering a credit report now is beginning to trigger the sharing of that interest in a home loan to a variety of other competitor companies. And the consumer is becoming overwhelmed with all sorts of sales pitches.
Senator Limmer, do you mean that after you apply for the loan, you go into your bank or to a broker, whatever?
Well, Madam Chair, once a customer begins a relationship with a mortgage company, of course they have to get a credit report to determine the credit worthiness of that customer. And as that process is beginning, if you're establishing a traditional loan or a stated loan for that matter, there'll be other verifications of income, sometimes liabilities for that particular customer. As that's beginning, but before the loan is officially approved, the knowledge of that individual consumer going about applying for a home loan now is being shared with a number of other companies. Some of those companies are on a cash or a contractual agreement with consumer reporting agencies to apply for that information. They want to know who is interested in getting a loan, unbeknownst to the consumer, until the consumer is overwhelmed with a lot of sales pitches regarding other competitive interests. This particular bill before us, as amended, would prohibit the sale or exchange with a third party, another competitor, the existence of that particular credit inquiry or the ability to get a credit report. Now, it does make some exceptions in the lower half of the amendment, and that's to assure that the original company doing business can at least share that information with whom they contract in order to finish the loan application. Large firms have in-house processing and servicing entities and departments to handle those loans. The smaller companies sometimes provide or they have a contractual agreement with service contractors to do some of that type of work, or they have to share that information with a secondary mortgage market, because they're going to sell that mortgage somewhere down the path, which is a very common thing that mortgage companies do. And a lot of times that secondary mortgage investor wants to know who or what kind of customer they're getting if they're going to buy that loan. But it's only specifically allowed for the narrow purpose of facilitating that consumer and their ultimate goal of getting a loan from that company.
So, Senator Limmer, so you probably wouldn't then be receiving all kinds of information, even with, because they're doing the servicing of the loan, or will, would be, or they'd be.
Well, Madam Chair, there's a, this isn't going to stop all of the inquiries that go to consumers. I provided a news clipping not too long ago, that was printed not too long ago, regarding kind of an exploding industry of sharing credit information, and yeah, that triggers sales pitches. Got a lot of competition today, Madam Chair.
My goodness. You'd think that it was a snow day and school was out or something. I don't know what in the world. If school's out, come to the Capitol.
Madam Chair, this isn't going to guarantee that consumers aren't going to get lots of information on home loans. There's a very robust industry out there wanting to find good, credit-worthy potential customers and give them lots of opportunities. This is a very narrow interest bill that once a loan applicant, once a consumer becomes a loan applicant and is starting that business relationship, that someone isn't going to tell the whole world that, hey, John Smith just applied for a loan because we know it because he triggered his own credit report. And then all of that information gets set out as far as their interest in getting a loan. It's getting to the point, I believe, that we do need to have a little narrowing how we handle this type of information. The consumer doesn't always know that that information has been shared with others. It's a very complex set of rules and regulations, as well as laws, not only on the state basis, but on the federal basis.
Members, are there questions or concerns? I think that some somebody has asked to testify. Do you have anybody to testify?
Not right now, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, I understand what you're trying to do, I think. And I mean, you want to try to protect the consumer, certainly. But aren't you worried a little bit that by trying to protect them, you may, in fact, be causing that consumer to have less competitiveness? If he gets into an agreement with a loan officer and maybe they're talking about an interest rate of 6%, but there's a bank down the road that would offer you that same loan for 5.5%, wouldn't that be better for the consumer to have those options available to them?
Mm-hmm. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm probably one of the most competitive-minded people in the Senate. But in this particular case, what we're finding, and you certainly have heard the stories, at least from the AG's office, of predatorial lending going on. They, too, have this information and rush to these particular people. There's about five different sources of initial money where mortgage companies get their draw in order to do business and offer loans in this country. And when you really get down to it, there isn't how you parse interest rates, amortization schedules, closing costs, it all kind of comes, no matter how you figure it and present it to the consumer, it all kind of equals the same yield to the investor. However, this I believe, does not stop competition. The customer, keep in mind, the customer has already made a point of decision after they've researched their marketplace of doing business with this particular company. And it doesn't necessarily stop, although there may be contractual agreements signed already, it doesn't always stop or alter the consumer from going out and shopping a little bit more if they think they found a better deal. Quite often, mortgage companies, even though they may not want to do it, if they know that another competitor out there is providing something a little less, the consumer will go back to their original mortgagor and tell them, and quite often some of those terms are negotiated. And so I don't know if it's necessarily curtailing competition, as you might suggest. This is just to the point that once a consumer gets to a point of decision and they're starting to make the closing on who to use for a mortgage company, that information shouldn't be broadcast to more third parties out in this world, where then all of a sudden, after paperwork has begun, after the consumer has already made that choice among the free market enterprise, that they don't get overwhelmed with all these other pitches. The other experience that I might relate to, and I've heard it from other consumers, and it's written up in that clipping that I presented before you, is that quite often these companies will know that you've applied for a mortgage, a loan application has been made, a credit report has been triggering it, and people will call you on the phone or they'll send you information of what you can immediately be creditworthy of. I happen to have an experience where I refinanced my house. 2 months later, a competitor called knowing that I had gotten a new loan, wanted to give me another mortgage. And not only another mortgage, they wanted to rewrite the entire mortgage, not a second. They wanted the whole thing. And they knew not only my credit score, they knew who I just wrote the mortgage to and what my entire liability picture was every month. And they said, you know, we can present you a better loan. What they failed to tell me when they focused on the interest is that the closing costs would be $7,000, and it would be, which in relationship to my loan that I had just signed 2 months before, was over $2,000 more in costs for me in order to take that loan. Remember when I started this out saying the yield really doesn't change? They lowered the interest rate, but they raised the costs up front. And the yield probably wasn't a whole lot different when you really looked at the whole package that I was obligating myself to. There's a lot of sources where people can promote their sales in their industry. I just don't believe that it should be at the point of sale or point of contract obligation when you start to go forward with a loan application. And the credit report is what triggers all this information.
And Senator Limmer, your bill really wouldn't deal with the kind of terms of a loan that are being offered to you or promoted to you. Yeah. So,
good, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
And to that point, and thank you. That's why I just wanted to make sure. I think, like you said, we want to make sure we protect the consumers. But, and I understand your point about the investors. But certainly, if you're looking at a 30-year fixed rate loan, you know, a quarter of a half a percent could make a big difference on that 30-year loan. So, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, but certainly, and there's other things that go into what happens to get a better rate or whatever. But I would certainly wouldn't want to limit some people from having that availability, or you know, if they go to a certain lender and they're going to say, okay, you're going to pay 7%, you can get it down the street for 6.5%. That was my only point. But I think as long as you say it doesn't affect it, then
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you. I don't know if you discussed this. I came in late, but as far as a consumer reporting agency, how would you feel about on line 110, after application, putting a period and deleting the rest of the sentence?
On line 10?
Senator Vandeveer, say that. Would you say that again? I'm sorry. We're looking at the A2.
Sorry.
Okay. We adopted the delete everything amendment. It's the 241A2. Should have it. There. Thank you.
Oh.
Okay, that's fine. We've all been there. Is that?
Oh, wait a minute.
Do you want to say something? Okay, Senator Vandeveer.
Okay, 1-7. Line 1-7. Wait a minute. Unless the third change with third party. Well, what I'm getting at is forgetting the mortgage loan and just say that the consumer reporting agency or any other business entity may not sell or exchange the information on the consumer with anybody, not just relating to a mortgage loan.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
That, for some of us, that might be something to consider, but I really would like to keep this bill narrow right now. That would open up a tremendous amount of discussion, and there's a careful balance between sharing information and allowing consumers to have options as well. And I'm not prepared to go that far today, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But thanks for the interest.
Any other questions?
I'll leave them alone.
Any other questions? You don't have anybody to testify, but I have Mr. Eric Ellman from the Consumer Data Industry Association who would like to testify on the bill. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm happy to be here. I mostly came for the weather.
Hi, of course.
And apparently I might be here a while.
It's quite beautiful, yes.
Thank you. I represent the Consumer Data Industry Association, CDIA. We are the national trade association that represents consumer reporting agencies like Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. We are the companies that provide the information that allows mortgage lenders and others to make decisions that ultimately hopefully work to the benefit of consumers by providing them with the best kinds of loan and similar credit products that they're looking for. And Senator Sparks has the point to this hearing and this process exactly right, and that is this bill is anti-consumer in that passing this bill is the equivalent of the legislature telling consumers not to clip coupons, not to read advertisements in the Sunday circulars, or not doing anything like that, because the offers that are provided to consumers in this context could have the opportunity to save consumers significant sums of money. There are a number of misconceptions about what a mortgage trigger product or what a mortgage trigger service is, what kinds of information it's provided, and what kind of information is not provided. So let me give you a little bit of background on what this is and what this isn't. The way it works is that a consumer who shops for a mortgage, a new mortgage, or a refinance, which is all perfectly legal under the FCRA, is required the information when it lands in the credit reporting agency's hands, that information is required by federal law to show up on a credit report. That's called an inquiry. Another company, a bank, a mortgage company, a mortgage broker, other financial services company, will often subscribe to what's called a mortgage trigger service, where they will be alerted to the fact that a consumer has applied for a mortgage or a refi. Again, all fully compliant under the FCRA. The offer may, in fact, that goes to consumers, may, in fact, be on significantly better terms than what the consumer has originally applied for. As you probably all know from reading newspapers and hearing other news accounts, consumers are not as educated as they probably could be in areas of credit and other financial health and other financial circumstances. And the American Financial First Services Association has done a lot of extensive research on all of that and ways that consumers, particularly kids, which is where it should be taught at the very young ages, could be better educated about what credit is and what it isn't. So the offers that consumers can provide, the offers provided by these can offer significant savings. And just because a consumer has applied for a mortgage should not lock them time immemorial in from taking advantage of better offers. Just like if you happen to go into finding a Toyota Corolla for $20,000, but you see it down the street for $19,500, just because you went to one Toyota dealer first, does that mean that you have to buy it from that dealer? You shouldn't have to buy it from that dealer. Consumers should have the opportunity to continue to be flexible and continue to look for better offers. A mortgage trigger product is offered under the Fair Credit Reporting Act for what is called a permissible purpose. It is a firm offer of credit. The mortgage broker that offers the loan has to offer what is called under federal law a firm offer of credit. Anyone who does not offer a firm offer of credit violates the law. The users of these trigger services are required to adhere to a number of very strict, significant federal standards. For example, the mortgage trigger product must certify to the consumer reporting agency, the user must certify to the agency that it has a permissible purpose to look at the credit report. Secondly, they actually have to make a firm offer of credit. They actually have to have the means to honor that offer that they make. And, for example, the mortgage broker has to have a contract that binds the lender to offer the product to the consumer. The user is required to provide a consumer of his or her right to opt out of receiving these offers. And a consumer can dial 888-5-OPT-OUT and be removed from these mortgage trigger lists and will never receive them again if they choose not to. That's 888-5-OPT-OUT.
Mr. Ellman, may I ask you
Ask
you a question here?
Just
is the trigger product, is that what is happening here, that somebody has bought
Yes.
information? And so
that's correct.
And bear with me.
Please.
So you're saying that if Senator Limmer applies for a mortgage loan and it that triggers, if I suppose that's where it comes from,
correct.
That the fact that he's made that inquiry, for particularly for a mortgage loan, not for a car loan, not for a credit card or anything else. Okay. So when the offers start coming to him, those are, am I understanding you that those are bona fide firm offers?
Well, if they're not, they violate federal law. If what Senator Limmer is getting in the mail is not, does not fit within the legal statutory definition of a firm offer of credit, then Senator Limmer has a right to sue them. The Minnesota Attorney General has a right to sue, and the Federal Trade Commission has a right to sue.
And do, would that also, though, be likely to come with the disclaimer that it does not constitute that, and it's pending further inquiry?
No,
so they're doing this without any verification of a person's continuing income, or
the credit bureaus are not allowed to provide a mortgage trigger unless the sender of the mortgage trigger certifies to the bureau that a permissible purpose for a firm offer of credit exists. So, for example, Madam Chair, if you are the bank and you are coming to me as a credit bureau saying, I would like to subscribe to this mortgage trigger service, you have to certify to me as a credit bureau that you are making firm offers of credit. Does that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Ellman, I've gotten offers from people, but usually there's a little asterisk and a little disclaimer saying, you know, you've been pre-approved for whatever, but there's always a disclaimer saying that they reserve the right to, I suppose, verify employment and do a more thorough credit check or whatever.
Yep. That is correct. If in fact the lender says, I can offer you 6%, for example, then the lender is required to offer at 6%. But if the lender says, I could offer you better, and if I can offer you better because if I verify your income, your debt to income ratio, and things like that, I can offer you better, that would still, depending upon how it's structured, would still constitute a firm offer. But the point is that an offer has to be made. And if the consumer says yes and they meet the terms, then they must be accepted.
Okay. I understand better now. Senator Vandeveer, did you have a question?
I do. Maybe to Senator Limmer, is a consumer reporting agency, is that a credit bureau?
Yes.
That it?
Mr. Ellman says yes.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'd rather hear
That's
from
okay.
him.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in addition to users having these obligations to make a firm offer of credit and have the means to do it, the bureaus have obligations too. For example, the bureaus have to make reasonable efforts to verify the identity of a person who subscribes to this mortgage trigger service, and not just anybody can sign up to subscribe just because they happen to have a check in their hand. The bureaus have to maintain reasonable procedures to ensure that nobody is violating the Fair Credit Reporting Act, including themselves. They also have to refrain from furnishing consumer reports if they have reasonable grounds to believe that the information is not being used in a way that the user has certified that is going to be used. The information that the subscribers get is very limited, and this is where a substantial myth comes into play. All that the bureau provides to the lender or the mortgage broker in this circumstance is the name and the address of the consumer, a non-unique identifier, which is specifically not a Social Security number, and is prohibited from providing any information pertaining to a consumer that identifies the relationship or experience of the consumer with the particular creditor or entity, which means that the bureau is prohibited from providing the name of the lender, any information associated with the lender, or anything like that. So any information that is being obtained on the consumer is not being obtained by the credit bureaus, is often probably being obtained from publicly available information like land deed or title information or things like that. If the consumers want to stop these offers from coming, they could dial a toll-free number at 888-5-OPT-OUT, I mentioned. They can go to optoutprescreen.com. They could subscribe to a do not call list, which prevents these phone calls from coming in, or they can tell these particular individual lenders not to call them anymore. There's lots of things that consumers can do to stop these things from coming if they don't want them to come in. Simply put, a mortgage trigger has an opportunity to save a lot of money. Here's an example. According to CNN Money Magazine, which notes that Brooklyn Park is one of the best places to retire in the nation.
Are you serious?
I kid you not.
I did his homework.
I don't make this stuff up. The same article that says that Brooklyn Park is one of the best places in America to retire also says that a median home price is $226,000. A consumer who puts 10% down on a $226,000 home and who applies for a 6.25% interest rate but then receives an offer to subscribe to a 6% interest rate saves about $12,000 on the life of a 30-year loan. That's big money by a quarter point. And these mortgage trigger services have an opportunity to go even further than that. They have an opportunity to push people from subprime into prime. And if you're talking about moving people several percentage points and their interest rate, we are talking about a substantial sum of money. In fact, the Federal Reserve has shown that 35% of all high-cost mortgage rates were taken out by minority people, African-Americans and Latinos. So this mortgage trigger service has particularly unique opportunity to provide substantial savings to low-income or minority people. The ban on mortgage triggers, like I said, is essentially the same effect as the government telling consumers not to clip coupons, not to read advertisements, not to go shopping, because what you're doing is you're locking a consumer into a rate that they might be able to take a better advantage of. It's false to suggest that they're illegal, as some people have. It's false to suggest that you can't stop the offers, because clearly you can. And there's a lot more that I won't occupy your time with, because I think I've given you a lot of valuable information, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
That is very interesting, Mr. Ellman. Senator Van de Veer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't this, though, that's really good that they can do all that with that information, but isn't this private financial information?
Mr. Ellman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if, in fact, you have what's called it is, in fact, private information, but the law allows certain information to be made available under particular circumstances. But it's certainly never public information. But it's certainly not necessarily private information either. Here's again the way it works. Senator Van de Veer, if you apply for a mortgage, federal law requires the fact that you've applied for that mortgage to show up on a credit report, because a number of years ago, Congress was under the impression that not everything that was happening to a credit report was being made available to consumers. So it has to go on the credit report.
But, Madam Chair, isn't it true that if just the fact that a credit report is pulled lowers your credit score?
Not. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Van de Veer, no. As a matter of fact, it is not. Again, it is a commonly held myth, but still a myth, that the more you check your credit report, the more your score goes down, and that's not true. It's also a myth that inquiries will move a score in a significant way in any direction. In fact, when you apply for a mortgage or a car loan, to name two examples, most, if not all, scoring models are constructed in such a way that any inquiries generated for a home loan or a home loan or a car loan within a 14 or 30 day window count as one inquiry for the purposes of a score. So if you go on a Saturday afternoon from Toyota dealer to Honda dealer to any other kind of dealer, Ford or GM, all of those inquiries are only going to count as one for the purpose of your score. The same thing for a home mortgage application. If you go to Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, if you go to Bank of America, all within a two-week window, it's just going to count as one inquiry for your score and has no impact.
Senator Van de Veer, then Senator Kretner.
Madam Chair, one follow-up. But the reporting you're talking about is for a specific purpose to, again, be used by maybe somebody that the applicant went to shop the loan. I mean, that it is reported on the credit report so that if somebody pulls one, they can see that you applied for these loans somewhere else. That's a little bit different than just wholesale selling this private information, I think. It's substantially different.
Mr. Ellman, I don't think it was a question. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You suggest that in a 24-hour period that all the requests are counted as one, but and you said that it doesn't count against your credit score. But just the fact that it's counted as one suggests it's a count against your credit score. So if the next one is a day later or 2 days later or a week later, then each of those is another point against the credit score. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Ellman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not at all. What I'm suggesting is, let me just back up a step to make myself perfectly clear. The way most scoring models are constructed, that any inquiry for a home loan or a car loan or other similar loans where people do a lot of shopping in a short period of time will count all inquiries within a 14 or 30-day window as one inquiry. So you could apply for 75,000 mortgage applications from March 1st to March 14th, and they will all be counted as one inquiry for the purposes of developing a credit score. Now, let's talk about inquiries and credit scores. The least important factor in developing a credit score is the fact that you have applied for credit. It is a factor, but it is by far the least important. The most important factor to determine a credit score is whether you pay your bills on time. And if you don't, then that is going to have an impact. The only thing that will move a credit score in any significant degree will be multiple inquiries in a very short period of time for things other than things like car loans and home loans, because these are things that clearly people do a lot of shopping for. And it's obviously a good idea. It's obviously a very pro-consumer move to make sure that consumers are treated fairly, because we know for a fact that they are doing multiple inquiries for car loans and home loans. So it's only fair that these be treated as one inquiry for the purposes of a score. But it is rare, the situation will be rare, that a score will move in any direction by simply applying for a home loan or even 75,000 home loans in a two-week window.
Okay, Senator Prentice.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Ellman, you're suggesting then that multiple requests for credit cards would raise your or lower your credit score.
It is possible. If multiple credit card, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator, it is possible that it could happen if multiple credit card inquiries are generated in a short window of time. It is possible that a score could move to a small degree in some direction. But that's important for lenders to know, because if in fact a lender sees that you are applying for lots of credit cards in a short window of time, it is a potential indication that you are in credit or could be in credit trouble and might be a bigger credit risk. But clearly the most important thing is whether you pay your bills on time.
Any other questions from members? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I listened carefully to this witness, and if you listen careful to the witness, he talks of a series of myths that are out there regarding the exciting and mysterious world of credit lending and credit reporting. However, most of those subjects that he was talking about really have very little to do with this bill. I'd like to bring our attention back to the purpose of the bill, and that's simply to state that a consumer reporting agency may not sell to or exchange with a third party the existence of a credit inquiry arising from a consumer mortgage loan application, except to do the business of affecting that particular transaction with that particular lender. And this was created, this whole idea was created as a result of complaints from consumers saying that they're just getting way too much. And at the same time, it also is somewhat after the point once that consumer is starting to make the decision. And in most cases, consumers, at least in my experience, I've been a real estate agent in the real private world that we all have a venture in. I've been a realtor for 28 years, and over those 28 years, not only involved in sales, but a real estate broker and a mortgage loan originator for 4 years. Most consumers do exactly what most consumers do. They go out and compare products, and they try to find the best deal that fits them. There's a newer method of giving loans, and that's through the facilitation of a mortgage broker who has association with a great number of loan providers, the original money. They, too, look for the best loan to fit the needs of that particular customer when that customer shows interest. So we don't have a shortage of competition in the mortgage industry. But once a consumer begins to narrow his focus and starts to start the paperwork and allow someone to dig into their particular private credit report, we're now finding that credit companies have mortgage trigger industries out there that information, quite often unbeknownst to the consumer, is being shared that particular consumer is now wanting to get a loan. And that's where this bill is focused on.
You know, that makes me want to ask Mr. Ellman, as long as you're still sitting there, I don't want to pick on you or anything, but are there other trigger products? Other trigger lists?
I don't know.
Okay.
It is possible that there are, but I just don't know for sure.
Okay. Does anybody else have a neighbor? We had
a neighbor.
Who, no matter what you bought, no matter what you came home with, whether it was a lawnmower or a snowblower or a new stove or whatever, they could have gotten it cheaper. That's anybody else. I have a car. You're that guy. Okay. You'd fit in really well in my neighborhood. Oh, I can't help but think of that you know, you're making the application, which means you want that product. You know the terms because you signed off on letting them get the credit report. So you know that lender is doing that, and that's the one you want, and now you're going to get other offers. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to Senator Limmer's position here, but I don't know. Other members have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks?
I don't know if that's necessarily true, because if you're going to pre-qualify yourself for a loan, you don't actually know whether or not you're going to get that loan, and you still go through the negotiation process after you're qualified. They look at your credit score. They look at your down payment, some other things, too. So, like I said, I understand what I think Senator Limmer is doing, but I think we also have to be aware that it is a comparative market, and the consumer has to kind of have some idea of what they're doing, too, as they negotiate through the process.
And just to follow
Senator Scogin.
Up on that, Madam Chair, mortgage is what we're talking about, and that's a big ticket item. I would like to think that I get some opportunity to think about the competitive nature of that once I'm involved in it, I guess. So.
Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon?
But, Madam Chair, I think I'd rather be able to do that on my own rather than being inundated with all these offers that I'm not sure I can sort through because of the nature of how they come to me. I'd rather be able to make my own roadmap and go check out where I want to. I think I'd hate to feel guilty because I didn't pick the right one.
Well, I know. I was also thinking of driving out in your new Toyota right past the dealership that has it on sale.
Okay.
It's a little too late. Members, what is your wish here?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Vanderbilt.
What if the bill gave the consumer the right to opt out of having that sold?
Well, Mr. Ellman said there is the one, I don't know if it's 1-800 or 888 opt something opt out.
Madam Chair, it's 8885 opt out, which is a right that has been given to all consumers in all 50 states and has been in effect for many years.
But, Mr. Ellman, is that available before the fact? So that's something.
Absolutely.
In fact, the
opt-out number that I just gave you is an opt-out number for all of these mortgage triggers. It's an opt-out number that applies to all of the credit card solicitation offers that people come into the mail. And if in fact there are other trigger services out there that I don't know about, it applies to them too. This number applies to everything. It's also optoutprescreen.com. You can do it today, and you will stop those from coming for the rest of your life if that's what you so choose.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I don't know how many of you know of what that opt-out number was as a household word between the beginning of this presentation or not. I don't think any consumer knows that, quite honestly, and quite often it's written in very tiny letters at the bottom of the page. We didn't talk about the phone inquiries. I don't think any phone inquiry ever tells a consumer that they have a right to opt out by calling another number now that they've already had a sales pitch delivered to them on the telephone. And it is not required by federal law. And so there are inquiries or pitches given to consumers without even that knowledge of that coming out. I would venture to guess that telephone calls are probably a lot cheaper than than the postage that goes into selling many of these products.
Senator Marty and then Senator Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think Senator Loomer is right. I mean, that opt-out number, I didn't know that opt-out number, and I frankly think I wouldn't have any problem with the opt-out if people knew it was available, but they don't. They simply don't, and they get flooded with the stuff, and there's a lot of personal information out there. I think Senator Loomer is on the right track.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellman, I don't remember the last time I looked at my credit report. Is my Social Security number on there?
Mr. Ellman.
Madam Chair, Senator, there's a yes but. First of all, a Social Security number is on there, and it's on there because the federal law requires everything that the credit bureau has on you to be on your credit report when you request it. It is in part allows you the opportunity to confirm the accuracy of the number. Secondly, you are also allowed, when you request a copy of your credit report, to request that the Social Security number be truncated. So if you request that you only want the last four digits on your credit report, that's all you get.
But Mr. Ellman, go ahead, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is my birth date on there, Mr. Ellman?
Madam Chair, Senator, your birth month and your birth year, but not the day.
So, Mr. Ellman, but that information, did I understand you earlier, doesn't go with to the trigger?
Absolutely
services.
Correct. Under these trigger services, all that a subscriber gets is a name and the address. They are prohibited by federal law from getting a Social Security number. Mm-hmm. They are prohibited by federal law from getting a number that is unique to that specific consumer, and they are prohibited by federal law from getting any information in the credit report whatsoever, period.
Okay. That is odd. Members?
You moving it?
Member Vandiver?
I'll say that it isn't the getting bothered part. It's because I didn't even support the telemarketing bill, but it's the wholesale distribution of financial information and private information that concerns me. But I'll move the bill.
Senator Vandiver has moved that Senate File 241 as amended be recommended to pass. Does it have to go?
Judiciary, data privacy.
And it will go to the data privacy, well, to judiciary, where data privacy will look at it. And they may be able to fine-tune it in a way, but I think you're making a statement with the bill. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. And Senator Loomer, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ellman, thank you. I hope you... Well, it's really rather pretty. Do you live in Washington?
I live in Maryland.
In Maryland.
Yes. But my wife and baby would like me home.
Yes. So I hope that you get there. Yes, of course. Yes,
thank you.
Senator
Marty.
Can I ask what that opt-out number was again?
8885.
It's 8885-OPT-OUT.
Or optoutprescreen.com. And you could also get on the do not call list to stop these calls, too.
Okay. Right. Mr. Ellman, thank you very much. And Senator Loomer, drive safely. Senator Tomasoni, I saw him. Yes, there he is. And I know you have a number of people to testify, so if some of the people wish to come up and be prepared.
Tell him to keep it.
And Senator Tomasoni, I know I've been on the committee before, and I think we've heard the issue, and most of the people here haven't, so... Obviously, we're not going to limit your time in explaining what it is you want to do. I just would ask that witnesses keep testimony as brief as possible. But
we'd just like to pass the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni, I know you would.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, can I make an oral change here to change the effective date to 2007?
You can't.
Nobody can.
I think you can do that.
Others remember.
That's fine, right, Mr. Stain?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Okay, yes. Do you want to move that?
Yes. I believe I'm an author on this bill, too.
Senator Pretner Solon moves. Well, actually, I don't even know if it has to be an amendment. Do you have any other amendments, Senator Thompson? Okay. To make the effective date this year as opposed to 2008. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair. Chair and committee members, Senate File 805 was brought to me by a constituent who had a problem that this particular law was the cause of. And as you can see, we have deleted due to functional congenital malformation of the ears. And this law is who can get hearing aids and paid for under insurance. The bill would extend coverage to children birth through 18 with an acquired hearing loss, and the law currently covers children with a congenital loss. The state already pays for hearing aids for MA, Minnesota Care, and state employees, so there's no cost to the state.
Senator Tomasoni, you've verified that. Is that part of the CGIP coverage?
Yes. Okay. And there are currently 2,300 kids in the Minnesota Department of Education with primary disability or hearing loss. Many are covered by the existing statute. Because the statute allows purchase of aids every 3 years, the overall impact of the insurance industry will not be significant. An estimated 46 kids will be added to the kids that are that already have coverage. Research shows that early intervention strategies for children who have been identified will save $30,000 to $200,000 during a child's kindergarten, elementary, and secondary education. For those 90 children identified a year, that is $2.7 million to $18 million savings over 13 years, and that's a statistic that comes from Johns Hopkins University. Costs to insurance companies will be offset by reduced costs in speech therapy. 40 out of 43 parents surveyed said that they receive speech therapy at a cost to the insurance industry of $8,000 to $14,000 every 3 years. One hearing aid would cost the insurance industry $1,600 every 3 years, and two would cost $3,200. The American Speech and Hearing Association says that costs for speech therapy would be cut by at least 40% if children receive early intervention, and this would result in costs being cut or offset to the insurance industry. Passage of this law will provide coverage for all children regardless of their hearing loss. We shouldn't discriminate against children and their families based on the cause of their loss, and there will be cost savings to the state and, we believe, to the insurance industry. So, Madam Chair, with that, who wants to go first, Doctor?
Yes, who would like
everyone
to go?
Everyone who wants to go. Patty Morelli, not related to me, but same nationality.
Yeah. We got to stick together. Yeah. Madam Chair and yes. Members of the committee, my name is Patty Morelli Teachout, and I'm the mother, I don't know if you can see this picture, of this beautiful 8-year-old boy.
He is, I can see
it. Can you see it? I don't know if I could see that far. But he has a mild to moderate hearing loss. And we were here 4 years ago, my son and I, working in connection with a bill that was passed requiring insurance companies to cover hearing aids for children born with a hearing loss. And since that time, I have been appointed to the Minnesota Commission serving the deaf and hard of hearing people, and I've also been contacted by numerous parents and audiologists throughout the state of Minnesota due to frustration over the bill as it stands, or the law as it stands now. Many parents have contacted me frustrated because they feel like their children have been left out with the coverage that as it stands. As these children, they weren't identified at birth, and or the loss occurred after birth, so that they did not qualify under the law that was passed 4 years ago. The legislation passed hearing aid coverage 4 years ago because it was the most cost-effective solution to treating our hearing-impaired children, and that cost-effectiveness applied to children that were born with congenital malformation but did not cover those children that acquired their loss later in life. My son, Will, here, he's now in the third grade, and he's been in speech therapy twice a week for the past 5 years. He did not receive his first set of hearing aids until he was 3 years old, and as a result, he missed out on a great deal of the language formation that happens during the early developmental years. However, at this point, has surpassed his peers academically, but at a significant cost to the education system and special ed system because of the intervention he's been receiving. I feel that if he would have been identified at birth and got his aids at birth instead of at 3 years old, that amount of money that has been spent on his education and special ed would be significantly decreased. We here in the state of Minnesota, do a great job of taking care of our kids. I think we can do an even better job of it. And as Senator alluded to, we can spend $30,000 to $200,000 on K-12 education for these kids, or we can get them identified early, get the aids set them up with aides appropriately and significantly reduce the cost to the state for their education. That's all I'd like to say at this time. Thank you for your time and your consideration in this matter.
Joe, thank you very much. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Margolis. I'm a professor of audiology at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine, and I'm delighted that you're considering a change in this statute that provides insurance coverage for hearing-impaired children who need hearing aids. The hearing health care community was thrilled when that legislation passed because it provided hope for children who would otherwise suffer irreversible harm from untreated hearing loss. However, the language of the current statute is problematic because it restricts coverage to children with functional congenital malformation of the ear. That language came from an old statute that addressed solely congenital conditions. There are several problems with that language. First, to most people, the term malformation means a condition such as a malformed limb that you can see or an organ defect that you can see on an X-ray or other imaging study. Defects in hearing are caused often by malformation at the cellular level that cannot be seen by any method. Whether or not a case of deafness is caused by a malformation is usually not known during the entire lifetime of the patient. Second, whether the condition is congenital, that is present at birth, or acquired in the early postnatal period is usually impossible to know. Third, whether or not the hearing impairment is due to a malformation or whether or not it's congenital is medically unimportant. If untreated, a significant childhood hearing loss causes irreversible harm, whether it is present at birth or occurs in the days or months following birth. Whether it is due to a malformation of cells in the inner ear or from a chemical disturbance of the inner ear is impossible to find out and clinically irrelevant. So the current law requires health care providers to make determinations that are impossible to know. I work with schools for deaf children in South America and India. I wish you could see the difference between those children who are not identified early and who do not get early intervention, and Minnesota deaf children. It's the difference between people who will be on public assistance for their lifetimes, who will not reach their educational and social potentials, who will be a net cost to society, and children who can live the same productive and fulfilled lives as their normal hearing sisters and brothers. We just need to close the loophole that can deny coverage to children with whose hearing losses were acquired a few days too late to meet the test of the current law. Untreated childhood hearing loss causes permanent language, social, emotional, and cognitive deficits. All children with hearing loss need access to hearing aids at the earliest possible age to prevent a lifetime of disability. I understand that there may be a call for a cost-benefit analysis if this change is to considered to be an additional mandate. We would argue that this is not a new mandate, but a clarification that aligns the law with medical realities and eliminates a loophole that causes great harm to families of children whose hearing losses were acquired a few days too late. Furthermore, based on the estimated prevalence of acquired childhood hearing loss, the change will add only an additional 46 kids a year with a very small financial burden. The immediate benefit is so great for these children that I urge the committee not to request a study, but to support implementation of this change as soon as possible. The small additional cost will be offset many times over by savings in services that are avoided by early intervention. Without early intervention, hearing impaired children require more speech therapy, as you've heard, but also more mental health services, more special education services. The impact of this change is a net cost savings in health care, education, and public assistance. So we urge you to pass this bill, give kids with hearing loss the treatment they need to be successful. All health plans should pay for hearing aids when they are the appropriate treatment for childhood hearing loss, whether the hearing loss is congenital or acquired, and whether or not it is due to a malformation. It makes complete sense medically and economically. Thank you very much.
Dr. Margolis, thank you. I have a question to ask, and someone who is going to testify next but is not on the list here is Mary Hartnett, and she handed out something, and it speaks to an estimate. You said about 46 kids would be added. Can you explain where that comes from? Or
yeah, that comes from an estimate of the proportion of kids with childhood hearing loss who have clinically confirmed acquired hearing loss, and the total number of children who get services for childhood hearing impairment in Minnesota currently.
Now, Dr. Margolis, I really was listening, but are most cases covered now, and we're trying to get bring in some?
Yes.
What's
it's
really
a loophole that
okay, I
causes
understand.
Some kids to be left out
right.
because
okay.
of these unimportant details.
Now I understand. Are you Mary Hartnett?
Yes, Senator Scheid and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Minnesota Commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. And as we mentioned before, the way that we arrived at the 46 kids, or estimated 46 kids, are the 2,300 kids that are currently in E12 in the education system that goes birth to 21. So it's not even 2,300. Then if you look at 20% of those kids having an acquired loss, that's 460. If you look at 30%, it's only 30% of the insurance industry that's self-insured. It's 30% of those kids. That would be about 138. Those 138 kids that are eligible to get hearing aids every three years according to the statute, and that's 46 kids. That's where that comes from. Then I also wanted to mention the other handout that we had. The last time that we came before you when you passed the law, we actually surveyed the parents. There were 46 parents in the room at different times. We took their actual bills from their speech therapy costs. You see, that's your last handout, I believe. We took their bills. We did an average of the costs of their bills for speech therapy. We took what the average cost of a hearing aid would be, the deductible, and then we took the and there is a misprint at the bottom of the page. It shouldn't say 4 months, but 4 times of speech therapy, or 4 months of speech therapy once a week for a year, during a year, it costs more than the purchase of one hearing aid every 3 years. So we believe that actually it could be of a benefit to the insurance industry, and we know that there is a trigger in place for studies to be conducted, but we actually are the commission that's supposed to be advising you on good policy for deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people, and we would hope that you would be able to support this. It will make a big difference. Thank you.
Senator Thomasoni, thank you. Is there any questions for either of these people? We have,
I'm ready to move the bill.
Well, Senator Metzen, there are some people that wish to testify, and I'm sorry they're not on your agendas. They're on mine, but we had people who told us this morning, and our committee page had already put this stuff together yesterday, and we just didn't get the updated list.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
This bill sounds like it's been passed before. What happened?
Senator Thomasoni, did
I think this bill has been passed. The law in front of you has been passed. But they have words in there due to functional congenital malformation.
I misunderstood.
In fact, Madam Chair, the way it worked for my constituent was that his child was born and had some other problems and was taken to the university hospital. They didn't detect the hearing problem. And so when they actually found out at about 4 or 5 years old that he had a hearing problem, qualified for coverage. And so had they detected it when he was born, he would have qualified.
Okay, thank you. I have Jeff Barch. I think that's a cell phone, that noise. Somebody has a cell phone that's maybe not turned on, but it's vibrating, and it does cause that in this room. So if anybody wants to check, we aren't taking names. Mr. Barch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barch. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs for Health Partners. For those of you who I haven't had a chance to meet yet this session or who are new to the committee, Health Partners is a locally based integrated healthcare system. We have a health plan. We have a large primary care and specialty care health clinic. We have dental clinics and a dental plan. We also have Regents Hospitals part of our healthcare system. So that's a lot of parts. While we are local, we are also the largest consumer-governed nonprofit healthcare organization in the country. The bill before you today, Senate File 805, is one of about 12 bills, I believe, now have been introduced to mandate certain coverages or treatments or, in some cases, payment policies on health insurance. Mandated benefits are brought to the legislature for a number of reasons. Many groups bring them, and in almost every instance, they're brought forward with very sincere and good intentions, and I think we would all agree that this is one of those instances. Today, I simply want to remind the committee some of the things that happen when we mandate benefits or why we do it. Hopefully, this will save some time, as this committee may or may not hear other mandated benefits that come before the committee. So two simple points I'd like to point out. Now, first, we need to remember, and this was pointed out by one of the other witnesses, that mandated benefits are only enforceable on the fully insured marketplace. That's typically small employers and individuals who buy a fully insured product as opposed to large employers who self-insure. That's about 27% of our marketplace right now, and that's a shrinking market. Most notably, it's shrinking because large employers and those who can are trying to escape from the realm of state regulation to provide more affordable product options for their employees. So I make this point only so that we remember that the decisions we make here don't always have the broad-reaching appeal that we would like them to have. The second point I want to make is that anytime you add coverage to a policy, you are going to increase the price of that policy. That's just simply how insurance works. The more that's covered, the more that is potentially paid out, and the more premiums you have to collect in order to potentially make those payments. Now, it may be an absolutely nominal increase, but it's a realism. When you add coverage to a policy, you actually add to the cost of that policy. And also, that's irregardless of whether that's a mandated benefit or if that's just a decision we as insurers decide to add coverage to a policy because we believe it's in the best interest of our members. It's also no secret to the members of this committee that small employers in particular, but everyone across Minnesota, is facing pressure from increasing health care costs. I think when you talk to people about health care, the number one issue they bring up is affordability. And I bring that up because we always want to keep that in mind when we're making decisions. So the legislature has about 12 mandates as of today in front of you. You may see some more. But you are going to be facing the same decisions that we as insurers make every day. What do we cover? How do we balance the want to provide as much coverage as we can to people with the want to provide an affordable product to consumers? And that is something we struggle with every time we review our medical policy, when we make benefit decisions as far as what is in the policies that we sell, and when we go out to sell those products in the marketplace. Sometimes a proposed mandate or a new opportunity for insurance coverage comes forward, and there's either no scientific backing behind it, or it's incredibly expensive and it adds no value to the system. Those are really easy decisions for us to make as far as whether or not we're going to add that coverage to the policy. In those instances, we won't. The decision you have here today is not an easy decision. I don't think anyone here is going to stand up and argue against the value of hearing aids, particularly for children. I'm certainly not going to argue against that. But it brings you to the situation we face every day, trying to find that balance. Up until a few years ago, we as a community had decided that hearing aids for children were the responsibility of the families to provide those hearing aids. That may or may not be the right or wrong decision. I'm not here to argue that, but that's where we were. A few years ago, we made the change to provide coverage to certain families, and now we're here talking about making the change to add additional families. Again, we're here before you, and you are responsible for making that decision, balancing the wants. And just to shed a little light on this, as I mentioned before, we're an integrated system, so we have care providers, and as an integrated system, we also have to follow just about every piece of legislation dealing with healthcare up here. That's a lot. I'll take this time to ask all of you, anytime you want to stop introducing bills, you certainly can. But when we get pieces of legislation, we send them out to the experts in our organization to get their feedback. And when this bill comes forward, we send it out, and I got two responses. The first was one from one of our audiologists who responded very quickly and said, "This would be great for kids. We should do this." Second sentence, "It's going to cost us something." The other response I got back was from our actuarial department saying, "This seems like one of the most more common sense mandates that we've seen, but we need to do a cost estimate of it and see if it makes sense and what our employers say when we add it to the policy." So, again, you're facing the same decisions we make every day. I'm certainly not here to argue against the value of hearing aids or not. What I'm telling you is in the past we've made these decisions in the marketplace, and we think for the most part they've worked. I'd be happy to answer any other questions the committee might have.
Senator Metzen?
Are there any other insurance savings that might go along with this? I mean, who pays is it the school system, the speech therapy, and are there other bills that, if this bill didn't pass, that the insurance companies would be paid?
Mr. Bartsch.
Makes sense? Could there be any other savings? Maybe it'll offset these 46 or 48.
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, I think when you're referring to the long-term costs of either speech pathology or educational costs that go into working with children who aren't diagnosed and who haven't gotten their aids correctly, there is most likely a savings to the system overall if you can avoid those treatments. Where those savings fall, whether or not it's on the educational system or whether or not it's on the insurance system, depends on who's getting billed for those services. There are school districts we work with to provide those services. Some districts we don't. In some cases, it may be a purely educational expense. In some cases, it may be purely a medical expense. But a lot of those potential savings are also long-term. They're not seen at the time that the payment for the hearing aid is made.
You know, Senator Metzen, with all these savings here, it would seem to me that sometime your industry, once out of a million, could come forward and say, maybe this one's all right. And you never, ever say that.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, actually, we worked with the groups who proposed this originally 4 years ago and sat down with them, and that's where we came to the decision that's in statute today.
And then, Madam Chair, today we'll straighten it out.
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, as I stated before, that's the decision that you're all facing today and will make.
And Mr. Bartsch, I wondered, could you comment on the number? I mean, you may not have access to those same numbers that Ms. Hartnett shared with us, but does this seem like these are the few that there is this loophole? And that we're really talking about the fewer number rather than the larger number. We're already covering the larger number.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, I would certainly agree that this is trying to capture a smaller set of people than the original legislation, although I have no reason to doubt Ms. Hartnett, although I haven't myself verified the numbers.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bartsch, I actually can't. It's unbelievable to me that hearing aids aren't covered for everybody. I can't think of any other disability or medical condition where this type of an assistance isn't provided. And personally, just having gone out and purchased hearing aids for my mother at the cost of $6,500 because she is low income and she can't afford them, and most low income people don't have a relative or somebody who can buy them for them. But I also realized that she suffered in silence for a number of years because she didn't want to burden any of us, and it was only that we finally were able to force her to get some hearing aids that I realized the quality of life that she missed out on and how much she pretended to participate in with us when she didn't know what was going on. So I don't have too much sympathy, quite frankly.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner-Solon, I don't think we're here today suggesting that hearing aids shouldn't be delivered to children who need them. In the first part of your question, I think eyeglasses are the perfect example of another instance where it's a medical equipment that we don't provide under most insurance policies. We simply haven't. Some states do. It's a decision that they've made to add that to the coverage policy. In Minnesota, historically, we had not included hearing aid coverage or eyeglass coverage, basically because as a community throughout the years we had made that cost-benefit analysis. And today you're just making a new adjustment to that cost-benefit analysis if you see fit. And as the legislature, that's your opportunity to do it.
And Mr. Bartsch, I know it's not easy, I think, for the insurers to come forward and testify against things that everybody on an ordinary day would agree are worthy. And, you know, I I think I signed on this bill because I think it is covering a relatively small number of people, and we had made the decision, is it 4 years ago, to include the larger group. But I think it's important that this committee weigh the issues here and decide whether or not this is worth that, and the fact that it is a smaller number makes me think it is worthwhile, particularly after the hearing last night in the E-12 budget division where we talked about special education and how we will save money down the road. And I understand that's not necessarily on our health care premium, although health care premiums, health care coverage does cover a number of services for special education students in many districts, if not, almost all different kinds of services. So I think, though, that if we catch these children earlier and parents are able to afford themselves the benefit of getting hearing aids for their children, that we will save money in the long run, as I said, not necessarily on your health care premium. Ms. Coleman, did you wish to?
Senator Schott and members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman. I'm Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations for Medica. Excuse me, I'll be very brief. Mr. Barsh here covered most of these things. But Senator Solon, just to your comment, I wanted to just let you know that as Jeff has talked about, Medica's position on this is not that we question the merits of the hearing aids for children. This is more to do with just the general principle of people understanding mandates. I would share with the committee that Minnesota is one of 11 states that has this mandate. We're one of only 3 states that does not have a dollar figure maximum on this mandate, and we have not proposed that we do that. The other issue for Medicare supplement products, there are riders that can be bought that do include coverage for hearing aids and eyewear. So there is something that can be purchased in the market, particularly for over 65. What I just wanted to briefly remind the committee is legislation that was passed in 2003 that provides for an evaluation of proposed health coverage mandates. The purpose of this legislation is to provide the legislature with a complete and timely analysis of the ramifications of all of these benefit mandates. We're not necessarily recommending that this particular mandate be one that should go through this evaluation process, but I think of the 11 other mandates you're going to see in front of you this session, there are some there that we really will question, that we would question the value, and they're very costly. So I just want to remind committee members, and if there's a page, I do have copies of the statute, so you can just have it. But just to remind people that we do have a process to look at the cost-benefit analysis, the value, how many people it would benefit, what is the science on the mandate, and we just need to remember that we have that tool available to us as we're trying to balance the very difficult issue of coverage and cost. So I just wanted to remind the committee of that.
Coleman, thank you. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wish, can we stop having people come in here giving us facts and things? I got a note from Senator Gerlach asking me if I really want to vote against hearing aids for children.
I think he just kind of boiled it right down.
I was, sitting here happily willing to vote for it until. But
private note.
private note. Oh, sorry.
Not anymore.
But
so much for anonymity.
I do wish that it went through that little evaluation process. I think to be consistent, I would say. That said, I'm not prepared today to vote against hearing aids for children, but it would be, the process is there for a reason, and it would probably come through fine, and we could still pass it if it didn't. But it just.
Are you suggesting, are you referring to what we've just had handed out to us?
Yeah, the evaluation. Oh, we have one?
Yeah.
Is it done?
No.
No, this isn't the evaluation. This is the statute 62J.26.
Oh, yes.
And
Is that something that really delays things? Or?
Senator Vanderveer, it looks upon refreshing my memory here. I haven't chaired the committee while we've had any of these, and I Mr. Stang was pointing out to me that this is what this does. You know, on this one, I don't know that I have to defend it, but I think to my committee I do. I don't think I would ask for this review on this because I think it is a small number of cases. Madam Chair Vandiver, I appreciate the suggestion. No, and I think this is good for members to know that we have. And in fact, if you want to tuck it away in your save file, you know, we're going to be seeing other things coming along, some of which, you know, we'll probably want to support as well. This is one of those things where people understand there's a cost to it, but all legislators usually end up, I don't mean to overstate it, but a lot of us, you know, have ended up voting for these over the years. But this one strikes me as a piece that was just left on the table and not covered. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, on that, I agree with you. I just was curious because I had to leave right when you were saying the 46 kids. By my looking, it looks like that's about 2% were not covered, and I missed the answer to it because I had to. Was it about
Senator Marty, I think that's
covered?
Correct. Okay. I think that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Metzen.
I'll move the bill. I think we made a mistake when we passed this. I was here that time, and that language shouldn't have been in here to begin with. But having said that, it's a right thing to pass this bill.
Okay, Senator Metzen, Ms. Sexton would like to speak, and then I want to give everybody a chance to be heard and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will be very brief. Mr. Varch did a very nice job kind of covering this, but I would like to just point out I am Aaron Sexton with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we have 2,400 members in the state, and 80% of which have fewer than 100 employers. So most of my members truly are that 27% of the fully insured market. And not only are they paying for these current 62 mandates, but also the MSHA assessment, the premium tax, and other things that are not our self-insured market is not subject to. So I would argue that a lot of these additional costs are falling on businesses who have the least ability to absorb these growing costs. And to some of the previous testifiers' points, I know they asked that health plans pay for this this increase in this mandate. And I would like to point out that health plans do not pay for this. They do not absorb this. It is passed on in premiums to those in the fully insured market. And those generally are my members. And although I recognize that this is small, and this might be one that was a loophole that was missed, and this one might make sense, and that's up to you as a committee to decide. Once again, it is small, but you are going to be seeing a number of these, and I hope as you view these mandates that you consider who is paying for these mandates and the growing inability of the people who are paying for them to absorb those increasing costs. So I would encourage you to consider that when you view these and appreciate the committee's time.
Sexton, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, you know,
to
that point, when the insurance industry business come in here and they say these kind of things that it might cost too much, the people that don't have the insurance are the ones that are paying for it. I mean, and to see the savings that these people would actually realize means that the actual employees of these companies that don't have the insurance are saving hundreds of thousands of dollars on costs that they would have to take out of their own pockets to pay for these things. So, you know, this is a little bit of extra premium, maybe. Maybe it won't be because they may determine that this does not have to have much of an increase, if any at all. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say it's going to cost people more as a result of this because the savings are pretty evident.
Well, Senator Tomasoni, I understand that, and I think in this case you're probably right. I think, though, in the overall scheme of things, when we look at the mandates and we look at the diminishing market of those who are not self-insured anymore, but are among what we call the fully insured. We need to think about, you know, where's the value? We want to be sure that we cover everybody, but at the end of the day, we may not be because they may be in a plan that does not have to abide by the mandates. And so, Ms. Sexton, did you wish
to? And I appreciate your comments, Senator Scheid, and to Senator Tomasoni, I only hope he's right, that this does not add any additional cost. I do think it is, generally, you're right, in some of these instances, it does make sense, but to your point, it is 27% of the fully insured market and a shrinking portion at that, and that is the way it's set up, and it's unfortunate that it is falling hardest on those small and medium-sized businesses who, once again, have the least ability to absorb those costs. So I understand his point, but once again, it's just not working for our small businesses right now. So,
Senator Marty, did you have? Senator, is there anybody else in the audience that wanted to speak? For or against the bill? Senator Metzen renews then his motion that Senate File 805, as amended, be recommended to pass. It didn't. I don't think it needs to. Was it requested by the It wasn't.
Never.
Okay. So this would go to the floor. Any discussion on that motion? all those in favor say aye. Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Madam Chair, Jeff Barshi, and I apologize. There was reference earlier about whether or not this coverage is already applicable in state government programs, which it is. But I do not believe it's covered for state employees.
Yes, it is.
They have added it to the coverage? Want to make sure. If not, it would have been required to go to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And that was why I asked Senator Tomasoni. If we would find out, you know, and we can verify that, obviously it will end up. Senator Cohen will grab it. Yes.
I don't want to do that.
Okay. On Senator Metzen's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, thank you, committee. This is Senate File 1193. It's a department technical bill relating to petroleum fuels, as far as I understand it. It conforms Minnesota.
I think this is the Weights and Measures technical bill, and I think all of us relate. We're kind of understanding.
It conforms Minnesota ASTM specification and codes to federal standards. I have Mark Buccelli from the department to explain it a little better.
Mr. Buccelli, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mark Buccelli, Director of Weights and Measures. This bill is what I call a housekeeping bill. What we've done is adopted the new, or proposed to adopt the new ASTM standards. If anyone doesn't know, ASTM is stands for American Society for Testing and Materials. It's an international organization. We use this ASTM and the Code of Federal Regulations for specifications for testing quality of petroleum products and fuels, which include gasoline, diesel, biodiesel, and so forth. So if you look through the bill there, you'll notice that we've just made changes there to adopt the new ASTM specifications. Also, there is a amendment on 3.7 in regards to diesel fuel. That language is being proposed to be removed. On the third page, 4.4, there's also language there that is no longer necessary, so we'll have that amended. or repealed, excuse me.
Mr. Bocelli, on page, on 3.7 or 3.8, excuse me, on diesel fuel oil, the stricken language is just not required anymore? Or
correct.
That standard is, okay. Well, I guess so, because it had to do with 2005, so I understand. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and then on 4.19, we've added a definition for biodiesel fuel. And again, in regards to it's basic, the generic definition of the biodiesel from ASTM. And then there's two other items. Well, on 4.24, that refers to revenue 296A-01 subdivision 14 in regards to diesel fuel. And section 6 on page 4, subdivision 25, gasoline blended with ethanol. We work with revenue on definitions in regards to petroleum products and fuels. And Pat may want to come up here from revenue to talk about those two items and some possible amendments. You also, members of the committee, Madam Chair, you have you should have a list of ASTM changes. If you look at the bill, our, what we propose, those ASTM changes occur.
It's an amendment, I think.
Yes.
The A2, Madam Chair.
Lots of letters and numbers.
Correct.
Yeah, the 1193 A2.
Okay. These ASTM standards change when we put this bill together, Madam Chair, in 6 months ago. These are the changes that have occurred since, so we'd like to be as up to date as possible.
First of all, it's a federal conformity bill. It's a technical bill. It's snowing outside. do we have to add the amendment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, can I move
Senator
the
Senator Johnson's moving the A2 amendment, and this will put the bill in the shape she'd like it to be. It would make it more up-to-date, more accurate for the department.
So the amendment is the whole.
Yes. So any discussion on that?
Aye.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion to fail. So the A2 amendment is adopted. And did you have anything else to add?
If the Madam Chair and members of the committee have any questions in regards to the other two items with revenue with 296, that's all I have.
Mr. Bocelli, does that mean that the bill, what you envisioned it going to the tax committee? I don't think so.
No.
That I'm aware of. No,
Madam Chair.
Okay. But you said you alluded to some other amendments. Are there other? Did revenue want to come forward with some things? And actually, and the chair at a point here is going to offer an amendment, which is my bill.
We saw that.
But we'll.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney in the Revenue Department. When we reviewed this bill the last day or two, we noticed that there were some changes in these ASTM standards that were being made to some of the definitions in commerce, but they weren't made to the same definitions in revenue. So I don't think it's critical, but our suggestion, I guess, would be to make those same changes to our definitions in 296A01. We have a definition of in sub 7 of aviation gasoline. We have a definition of gasoline in sub 23 of 296A01. Gasoline blended with non-ethanol oxygenate 296A01 sub 24.
Do you have an amendment then?
Well, I drafted something, yeah, but I don't have. I mean, I can give you a copy of what I have. It's
yeah. We should have that.
Use that for works.
That'll be put on in my committee. Didn't mean.
Yeah. How?
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Thanks.
Madam Chairman.
Okay, there. I understand, Senator Metzen. We're going to finish. We're not wimps.
I'm just wondering how we could have a department cleanup bill that's not cleaned up very well.
Well, Senator Metzen, it's two departments, and
they don't talk to one another, I guess.
And we know we have.
Madam Chair, all that amendment does is make the same ASTM changes to those definitions in the.
Thanks.
In the petroleum tax statute that are made here in the weights and measures statute. The ones that we assumed that they would be picked up, and then when we saw the bill, they weren't, so we're just.
And they're not in the department's bill that's in the tax committee.
Normally these technical ASTM changes are, we do them jointly with Commerce, and they don't go through the tax committee.
Okay. Mr. Finnegan, I think the bill may go to one other place depending on testimony here from someone. And I think that what we'll do is have this drafted up as an amendment for that stop. I think members understand it's just making the technical references to the ASTM standards. Okay. And making them consistent for revenue purposes, Department of Revenue purposes, as they are for the weights and measures.
Yes, Madam Chair.
In Commerce. Okay, thank you very much. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Ms. Coble.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Coble. I represent Flint Hills Resources, which is an oil refining company. And I did have an opportunity to talk with the chair as well as the author and the department. And one of the things in the bill that we would like to have some further discussion, and it might be appropriate for the Energy Committee, has to do with the definition of biodiesel. And I think there's an opportunity here to perhaps take a stronger look at the federal language that's currently in law and also adapt that here. What that'll do is give us a greater opportunity to look at a variety of different biodiesel technologies that are now currently being investigated, because it would give us an opportunity to get more renewable fuel actually into our fuel here in the Twin Cities. So we would like to sit down with Commerce and see if that would be acceptable to them and others, and if we could take an opportunity to work with them between now and perhaps a stop at the future committee, where we could take a look at this from a technical standpoint with the language, we would appreciate that.
And when Ms. Coble mentioned this to me after a session today, it dawned on me that this is, you know, we in Commerce Committee don't get paid to do this issue. They get paid over in Senator Brettner Stolen's committee to look at that kind of issue, I think. And so in terms of what would define biodiesel or what would do a better job of that, given that obviously that's not standing still, that's, you know, going forward, great guns. So I don't think we're qualified to make those decisions. But so then I would ask that the bill be re-referred to Energy, but this will be fun, Senator Johnson, with a department technical bill.
Madam Chair, I do agree with the 20% change.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, there was one
and
other thing.
And that's part of the bill. Yeah.
The one other thing I do want to just say on that 20% section is I just want to make sure I understand that this is perhaps to try to get ready for a 20% ethanol mandate that's in effect, but just for the record, to make sure everybody knows, until the federal government would approve a 20% mandate, it would be currently illegal for us or for anyone to put 20% ethanol into any gasoline blend. So I just want to make sure that I have that on the record, and I know that the department knows that, and I just wanted to understand that that's for future reference but not currently.
And that is something that I suspect they will be looking at in the Energy Committee as well. Senator Sparks, would you chair? Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on the bill? As I mentioned to members, I have a bill next on the agenda, Senate File 1237, and I think I know that Mr. Stang has drafted an amendment, and it's the A1, so it's the 1193 A1.
We're going to add this.
And it will
There. Why don't you build a sink with the other one?
Well, I've been thinking about this, as a matter of fact. I suspect Mr. Krogman is probably wondering what I'm doing here. Well, no, I think we did have this conversation, and I think that it probably will work just fine here, and that we can find a place for this language at some point if something happens with the technical bill. But I think the technical bill will be fine. If they can't work out the biodiesel issue, I'm sure the technical piece will go forward. You know, I don't see that that's any controversy. So, members, this is pretty self-explanatory, and I'm kind of doing penance. When Mr. Krogman brought the bill to me, he didn't have any idea that I had this happen to me, but I went inside the gas station while my car was being filled with gasoline, and when I came out, I had pretty much flooded out a Super America station single-handedly. It was pretty awful, and I mean, I was afraid to start my car to drive away or to
throw a cigarette.
Open the door. Oh, I had quit smoking about 25 years earlier, but so that wasn't a risk. Anyway, you can see what this says. It says that you have to be in attendance by the dispenser nozzle during the fueling process. I have seen this happen to other people, and you know, we all assume that it's going to click off, and it didn't click off. It clicked out fell out of the tank and was all over the ground. Senator Vandeveer.
Madam Chair, you have to be in attendance or what?
Well, it actually says it's guilty of a misdemeanor. I don't
Not
know.
Anymore, Madam Chair.
We took that out. Thank you. Because I thought we maybe should take that out. Mr. Krogman, did you want to speak to
no.
this?
Madam Chair,
yes,
I would like to comment that when I fill my gas, I've done it before, so now I notice the sign that says you must stay in attendance.
Right.
It is on the pumps, Madam Chair. But I won't oppose the A1 amendment, though.
My picture isn't with it, I trust. So.
That's at the post office.
So I'd like to move this amendment.
Mr. Krogman, do you want it?
Mm. No.
Yes? No.
Got to earn his pay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Market Association. I'd simply say that we support this and hope you do pass it.
Thank
I'll
you,
answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Krogman. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to be a fly in anyone's ointment here, but I want to speak against the amendment. And it's difficult for me to do. Senator Scheid, we've had a lot of agreement over a lot of things, and certainly I've worked with Mr. Krogman, and he's ably represented the petroleum marketers in the past. But when I first sat down here today, I saw this, and I thought, oh, I guess he's here to testify against this. And I found out, oh, no. And I would just say this. First of all, when I look at this, I'm wondering, you know, certainly this happens, and it ought not to. But I think this is one of those things where common sense, I'm going to go lightly, dictates that the general population ought to watch what they're doing when they're doing these things. And if they're not, well, then, you know, there's consequences to that. I don't know that the solution to every problem is a law, and I'm glad you took the criminal penalty out. I'm not sure if there is any penalty, and if there's nothing in here, then why have it? I mentioned to Mr. Krogman, I said, well, what usually, I said, you're usually, you know, here fending off government involvement in your business with city councils and sign ordinances and all these sorts of things. And that's why, you know, here you're saying, government, I'm inviting you in to put these requirements on me. And I asked the question, why can't a business, I mean, Senator Johnson just said that there's signs that say you must stay in attendance. Now, clearly, that's not backed up by law, but people may think it is, and businesses voluntarily
Madam
do
Chair.
That.
Senator Johnson, not all gas stations require it.
That's right. Not all, but some do. And if it's a problem, then maybe the gas stations should voluntarily, through the association, as they discuss this in their meetings and whatnot, agree just to put the signs up without a government mandate to do that. The other thing is the language in the bill, or the amendment, it says be in close attendance. Now, Joel Carlson isn't here, but I think the trial lawyers are very interested in language like that. What does that mean? Does that mean 10 feet? Does that mean can you clean out the garbage in your car while you're gassing up? Is that in close attendance? If the garbage can is in between you then, and you can't rush over there. I mean, any kind of a trial lawyer is going to drive a truck through that, and then there's liability issues. Somebody's going to get hurt and get sued. I don't know. I just think that this is a law that is completely, I'm going to say it's gently, maybe unnecessary, and that I think that if by putting it on this technical department bill, I think you add a dimension to it now I got to think about, and do I want to do this? So that's my 2 cents worth. I probably know what the votes are.
Sure.
Like half a buck.
Senator Vanderveer and then Senator Solon.
I'm just wondering if Senator Gerlach would have been better off voting against hearing aids for kids than arguing with the chair on her bill.
Senator Solon, that's my good only point. Comment. Very good point, Senator Solon.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I also wonder if there isn't some responsibility on the businesses. In the past, they were the ones that did the pumping of the gas, and the mechanisms are supposed to turn off. You'd think that there is some responsibility on the business to have facilities that protect them from accidents like this. And I'm concerned that we continue to move the liability onto the individuals.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I can't help you. My dad owned a gas station for 40-some years, and I pumped gas a lot, and I knew better. And I think, and the one thing my dad said when he sent me off to college was, just don't leave your common sense there, you know. Come home with it. And then, of course, he moaned a whole lot for the rest of his life that I turned into a Democrat while I was gone. So that bothered him a lot, but I'm telling you, it all came together for me when I flooded out that. I mean, if you could have seen it, Senator Gerlach, you'd have said there should be a law.
I know you would have.
I know you would. Yeah, I think even you might have said that.
I believe Gerlach.
I ruined my shoes.
I
walked. I got home smelling. It was just terrible. Just smelling gasoline. It was awful. So I think that this is one of those things. Obviously, it's not a penalty, but I think it would be a good thing to require. By the way, this is the only time I've ever gone in the station, so there you go, while I was pumping gas.
Senator Scheid renews her motion on the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I'd Senator like to Johnson. Move the... Set of file 1193 as amended.
Four no votes?
Senator Johnson moves that Senate file 1193 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Energy Committee. Energy. Now I've forgotten your long name in telecommunications. Energy. I'm missing
energy.
That's close.
Energy, utilities, technology, and communication.
My goodness, yes. All those in favor, any discussion? Anybody else want to testify on this? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Yes, thank you. And members, the meeting's adjourned. Drive safely. Oh, my. I think so, too.